This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I am Helen Farmer on today's episode of Afternoons. We are marking Drowning Prevention Week, speaking to a swimming instructor and hearing the real life story about what you need to know to keep your kids and yourselves safe around the water, from what to wear and what not to wear to how early can you start teaching water confidence in your kids. Exploring internships with the founder of Fursa at just 17 years old, recognised a real gap in the market and has created an app for it. And are you a mouse jiggler? We've seen cases in the US of people being sacked for, well, faking their productivity. We were talking tech with journalist Kevin Sebastian and discussing quiet quitting. This is definitely a form of that, with HR industry insider Rohini Gill. And in the Psychology Hour, it was Dr. Thryer as we discussed the importance of community, volunteering, charity, acts of kindness to avoid loneliness, helping you out anonymously on the text line. It is Drowning Prevention Week. It is the third leading cause of unintentional injury death worldwide, accounting for 7% of all injury-related deaths, and globally the highest drowning rates amongst children aged 1 to 4, followed by children aged 5 to 9. But very, very preventable. Of course, it's Eid break. Lots of us at the beach, the pool, heading off on holiday into the summer as well. So we're talking about understanding the risks and how to prevent them and to help us navigate these waters. We've got Chloe Smith with us, area manager and Swim England tutor at Hamilton Aquatics. Lovely to have you with us, Chloe, and Eid Mubarak to you and yours. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. Very pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
I am. I'm pleased because I feel like some of these conversations can feel a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, God, those numbers are horrendous, especially when you think about those really little ones. But it's so easy to kind of turn a blind eye and be like, well, that's something that could happen to someone else. And we are going to be hearing from Ola Carberry later, who did have a tragic accident that happened in her family. Would you mind explaining maybe some of the common mistakes that people make that can lead to drowning or near drowning?
Yeah, definitely. I think you touch on a really good point, that it is so preventable. And that's the most important thing here, is the fact that we can teach technique and teach really simple rules that stop any sort of drowning before it needs to occur. Mm-hmm. So at Hamilton Aquatics, our first port of call is to teach water safety. And that's making sure that your child goes to the poolside with either a responsible adult or making sure the lifeguard's there before they even get in the water. And I think if you as a parent can instill that rule first, you've overcome a very large amount of risk. Mm-hmm. And you can then start by introducing water safety and being safe in the water whilst they're in there.
I think it's a big part of it here is just how often we're around the water.
Completely.
You know, swimming pools, being at the beach, birthday parties, things like that. Where it can get difficult, though, is where you've got kids who have absolutely no water confidence or knowledge, all the way to the kind of little fish that have been, you know, brought up. Yeah. with parents who perhaps are a bit more proactive when it comes to water confidence. What role does a parent have when it comes to overcoming maybe even their own fears and passing that on to kids?
Completely. Like, you have to make sure that you introduce water in a fun and exciting way, because everyone is enjoying the pool and they should enjoy the pool. And it's making sure we instill that first. Mm. So my recommendation for parents would be to make sure that you get that introduction to swimming first, and it be fun and exciting but also safe. So, like, for example, making sure that their time in the water is fun and unstructured and it's led by them, so that they can understand what the water is and how to sort of act around it.
What we kind of struggled with was my kids were almost overconfident. So
it's a thing.
Mm-hmm. It is a thing. It is a thing. And then I'm sure a lot of people have lessons with their kids when they're, you know, their babies. Mm. And we're in the pool with the little ones, and then they got to toddler age. And I remember the instructor saying, you know, they can swim, but they don't listen.
Completely.
So they need to sit on the side and they will be with you until we believe they are old enough and mature enough.
Yes.
To be able to get into that water and get out of that water safely.
Mm.
So a maturity piece can come into play as well.
Oh yeah, completely with that one, because it's all fun and exciting, but as a parent, you have that sole responsibility to keep them safe first. Mm. And that happens from, you know, the very first time you take them into the pool, be that 3 months old or be it 3 years old. But also at the moment, if your child is a little bit later to the swimming environment, still making sure that that introduction is fun and exciting, albeit that they're 6 years old and now we're battling a little bit for fear of the water. Mm-hmm. So it looks different at every stage, but I do believe, and I truly passionate about the fact that everyone should have should enjoy the water for what it is. Mm-hmm. But we have a responsibility to make sure that is safe.
What about when you can leave them unsupervised?
Oh, see, this one, I truly believe that it should never be unsupervised. And it's one of the main water safety aspects that we instill in all of our swimmers. A, you should go swimming with a responsible parent, or making sure that there's a lifeguard on poolside 24/7. And that's a non-negotiable. That should happen from the ages of 3 years all the way up. Even as an adult, you shouldn't go swimming by yourself.
So we are talking water safety. And one woman very, very passionate about it, Orla Carberry, sharing what happened to her and her family.
21st of June 2016, tragedy came to our door. Basically, we were at a private pool in Jumeirah Gulf States, and Aoife was at just, we were having at a friend's house. There was a drain, unbeknown to me, there was a drain at the bottom of the pool, and it had no cover on it, so it was like a vacuum cleaning system. My three children were in the pool, and also some friends' children as well. To cut a long story short, basically, Aoife was swimming beside me at the bottom of the pool, being a mermaid. What I didn't realise was that the drain was faulty, and she had taken a leaf, went to put the leaf into the vacuum. Kids being curious, I'd seen it was a suction and a vacuum, and anyway, it sucked her arm in at the bottom of the pool. And what I just want to reiterate is that basically, well, two clear things, is that Aoife was a very strong swimmer, so I thought I was doing everything right, and that also I was with her. So I never leave my children, particularly around water, and so I was probably less than 6-7 feet away from her. I had my older child, Connor, at the time, who couldn't swim, was in my arms. So, like, Aoife had literally been under my leg, swimming, you know, through my legs as a mermaid about 5 minutes before that. So, you know, on that day, I thought I was doing everything right. I was supervising her. Little did we know what was about to happen. And so very quickly, calmness turned into chaos. And Aoife was, when we found her, she obviously had been submerged for a long time. Sorry, Hannah, it's still very raw. So even, just, I just want your listeners to know, so even though this happened a few years ago, it's still very raw today as it was then. So anyway, she was gone. She had had a cardiac arrest, and it took some time to get her released. And the time we got her out, she was gone. But fortunately, I'm a healthcare professional. I work as an OT, I knew CPR. So my friend called emergency services straight away, and I started working on my daughter. After about 40 seconds to a minute, I don't know how long it was, but basically, Aoife took a breath and got above, gave her back to us. And since after that, Helen, actually, sorry, she remained in ICU for 3 days. So even after that, she was critical. The happy ending is that after 3 days, she went on to make a full recovery. After her accident, I just had a huge passion and responsibility on my shoulders to create awareness and drowning prevention and educate throughout not only Dubai but the UAE. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is our home, and that if I can get the message out there on water safety to prevent it happening to even just one family, well then my goal is achieved.
Orla Carberry there speaking to me earlier about what happened to her daughter Aoife. And by the way, if you want to find out more, it's Aoife's campaign on Instagram. Some really fantastic information there, and obviously sharing more about activities and events and outreach. And we're talking now to Chloe. She's speaking to us from Hamilton Aquatics. She's a Swim England tutor area manager as well. I mean, it's just terrifying. And as, you know, Orla's saying there so rightly, you know, Aoife, great little swimmer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her mum there the whole time. It was a faulty drain that led to this near tragic incident. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what to do in an emergency. You know, you do a lot about water safety, but, you know, what do we need to know as parents and caregivers should the worst happen?
I mean, that's just the scary thing. Like, she's done everything by the book, and these instances can happen out of nowhere. And that's why it's so important that parents and swimmers and everyone is educated in what to do. The best thing I think parents can do, if they don't already, is unfortunately, maybe get themselves qualified in CPR.
So absolutely. That, we hope we never need to use it.
Exactly. You know, all our teachers and and everyone that's on poolside is CPR trained, because unfortunately these accidents do sometimes happen. So even if you don't ever use it, you're safe in the knowledge that you've got it. Mm-hmm. So definitely that's tick number one. Tick number two you could probably introduce is making sure that your kids can be seen, because you're going to have loads of people on poolside. And if your kids can be seen, you know they're going to be watched by lifeguards, by yourself, by hopefully another responsible adult on poolside. And I don't know if you've seen yourself on Instagram, but a lot of these videos where they're highlighting the importance of the clothes that they're wearing. So not picking out the awesome blue T-shirt that could be blended perfectly in the bottom of the pool, but go for the outrageous
orange, neons,
bright yellow, all of those. Get them on there, because the moment they are under the water, just like that story, they can be spotted. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to be under there, but like with the glare and stuff like that, and hopefully the lifeguard will jump into action straight away because of just a t-shirt. It's so simple.
Chloe, number of questions for you, comments as well. A message here saying, we had an incident 3 weeks ago where my wife could have very easily drowned. She was born by the sea, can swim like a fish, but we went to a pool club and she went for a swim. I went to order food, turned around a couple minutes later, couldn't see her anywhere. Ran to the pool and found her on the bottom of the pool, not moving. Managed to get her out into recovery position, called an ambulance. She had an epileptic seizure. The life and nobody else had noticed. I absolutely agree with Chloe that no one should ever swim alone. She's okay now, by the way. Goodness me. Thank you for sharing that. And a message here from James. Question for Chloe. What's the best skill I can teach my child at the earliest age? Great question, because again, I've seen some really interesting videos where children are being taught how to, you know, roll onto their backs, you know, how to get themselves out of water. You teach really littlies.
I do, yeah.
So what are some of the things that you think could potentially life-saving to impart onto our children? I think obviously going through a qualified instructor is the best way, but parentally as well.
Yeah, I think that I think many parents out there would agree that it's very difficult to teach your own child. So if you've not already enrolled them in swimming lessons, then do so. But if I could take it through the ages, if you've got a small baby, my first advice would be, and it's very simple, but sometimes parents don't think about it, but when you get the baby into the pool, make sure that their feet are facing the pool edge, so that the moment they start to turn and then they're going to start to crawl, they're just going to crawl away from the pool, because that's the direction that they're in. So that would be my first one if your baby is very, very small. The next stage I would recommend would be for if your child is maybe like three years old, jumping into the pool, great fun, amazing fun, but make sure that they know they can only jump when the parent is there and it's cued. So like 1, 2, 3, jump, great, amazing. And then you can start introducing as they get older to jump into the pool, but turn around by themselves and swim to the poolside. Because the moment they can find that edge and they can swim there, that's, you know, when they're going to stay safe.
What about flotation devices? I've got many an unhappy memory of being by the side of Prudhoe Waterworld, absolutely disgusting pool, by the way, having water wings jammed on my arms.
Yes.
And then now we've got all sorts of different kind of, you know, vests with floats built in. We have, you know, rubber rings that they can sit in.
Yeah.
From a safety point of view, I've been told don't use them. You know, if you can use anything, maybe one of those shark fins that gets their body into a proper position. But I understand the peace of mind that having your kid in basically a floating suit can offer a parent. What, from a safety point of view, Chloe, what do you think?
From a safety point of view, I would always recommend to go for a flotation device that is attached, so that, for example, when they take that jump from poolside, it's not going to fling off. So you want one that is attached, be it like one of those awesome little jackets. Some jackets also give you the option to take out the flotation device, so that when they become more and more confident or a little bit bigger, you can then take out the flotation device and it be more prevalent on them to float by themselves. Mm-hmm. But you've still got that aspect of safety in there.
Also had a question saying, when is the earliest they can learn to swim? I mean, swim is like a kind of a bit of a grey area, I suppose. But when, in an ideal world for everyone listening today, would you like to see little ones get into the water?
It really is dependent. And I would speaking from a point of passion, I'd say, you know, the earlier you introduce them into the water, the better it is. Your younger swimmers, like ages between 1 to 3, is very much introduction to the water and having fun. But once they reach that age of 3, you want them in the water loving it, so that you can enroll them into lessons, and that's when they can start taking off and really enjoying
and
what it is.
It's such a choice as well, because, you know, schools have got an awful lot for them to be juggling. And, you know, I don't know if other schools are the same. Let me know. Ours are like, OK, you've got second half of term 2, you know, is going to be your kids' swimming lessons. They're not going to be in the water on a weekly basis. They haven't got the pool time to be able to manage that volume of students. So I don't think you can rely on schools to be teaching everything that your kid needs to know. And you also teach adults as well, we should say.
Yes, I do.
So to be able to enjoy everything, you know, the UAE and indeed the world has to offer, it has to be a bit of a family affair, I think, sometimes.
Oh, completely, yeah. I mean, and you're so right with what the schools do. The schools do a fantastic job, but they've got such a large quantity of kids to get through.
And
the
again,
water.
With a massive range, you know, and my 7-year-old in her class, she's got kids that have never swum before going to school, and they are relying on that school to get them water confident. So they're in the little pool. Then they've got other kids who, you know, might have had some lessons or a bit, and then you've got them where they're going, doing lengths up and down. So,
and then you take them outside of school, and they need that lesson, because they need to boost it up. It's so that when they become adults themselves, they can enjoy the pool and enjoy going down to the beach and stuff like this. Yeah.
With your permission, if people want to send me the word swim, I'll share the details of you.
Please,
would that
do.
Be okay?
Yeah, no, 100%.
Brilliant. I've had That'd messages asking about Aula as well. So if you want to send me the word swim, I'll send you everything for IFA's campaign around swim safety, but also Hamilton Aquatics as well. Chloe Smith, really appreciate
thank
your
you
time.
Thank you so much for having me,
and thank you to everyone who reached out. Some really, really scary stories, but I mean, I've seen this in a pool in Ras Al Khaimah where, you know, a kid being dragged out, and it never ever leaves you. It really, really doesn't. But it is things that are within our control as parents. So this Drowning Prevention Week, do take some steps to do what you can to keep you and yours safe. We're talking tech, we're talking teens, and joining us, bless him, on his Eid break, we've got Khaled Haj. He is the brilliant 17-year-old founder of the Fursa app. It's designed to bridge the gap between education and industry, revolutionising how high school students here in Dubai can find internship opportunities. So we're going to be talking about this platform, making them more accessible, challenges he faced in developing the app. Khaled, Eid Mubarak, how are you?
Eid Mubarak, I'm great, thank you. How are you?
I'm really well. So you're 17, you're at American School Dubai, 4.0 junior student. And I have to say, congratulations.
Thank you. I love
the idea of being so proactive in an area that so many parents, pupils, and actually teachers as well struggle with, this idea of finding an internship. Tell us a little bit about why you wanted to create this app. Was it something that you'd struggled with yourself?
Yes, me and my friends, actually. So one summer, me and my friends were all really looking to work somewhere. And, you know, we just struggled because there isn't really a platform where you can just go and search and look, you know, really. The people that get these jobs are the people that just have a connection with a company.
the Wasta.
Yeah, the Wasta, exactly, yes. And yeah, so, you know, we found it tough to browse. So, you know, when I was doing my internship that I found, I think the main concern was, you know, for other students our age and colleges, actually, when you want to work in the future, they always require, you know, some experience. And we thought that it was very essential to get that experience at such a young age and get started, really.
Yeah, because we can, you know, we're just talking off air about, you know, what you might study in the future. But how do you actually know that that's something you want to do unless you've been in a company and, you know, seen the day to day? You could get there and be like, actually, absolutely not. Yeah. Or, you know, this is a brilliant company. You have to
just explore.
You have to explore. Yeah. So we know what students get from kind of internships, but what about the companies? I mean, that's a great opportunity to tap into young talent as well. I don't think enough companies realize that.
Sure. Yeah. And I think also having one platform where they can kind of see all these students, it's very easy for them to manage and see, you know, what interns are looking for, you know, see the qualities of each one and stay in touch. So I think it really is a good opportunity for both the companies and the students to have one mixed kind of platform.
It is. I mean, it's one thing to go, this is a bit of a problem. It's another thing to go, oh, I know, I'll just create an app for it.
Yeah.
Tell us about the process then.
Sure. So yeah, Fursa is definitely a solution to a problem. So we first just thought of the idea, and I spoke to my dad about it, who's, you know, helped me a lot. He's in obviously the business world, and I've definitely learned a lot from him. And just thinking about the idea, we wanted to, you come across a bunch of problems in your everyday life, but we just thought that we wanted to actually make this problem into a business and, mm-hmm. and create it and make a solution from it. So we first, you know, we're thinking about creating a platform, and then we were looking, browsing for development teams and seeing, you know, which company, which development team we think could develop the app the best and meet our needs the best. And we ended up finding, you know, the right team, and we've been working on it, you know, since last summer. And yeah, we branded it, we made a logo, and we really made it from just an idea into an actual platform, which is great.
That must be a really proud moment, seeing it on the App
sure,
Store.
For sure, yeah, it is. My name on the developers. And,
that's so cool.
Very cool.
You're helping other people get the edge when they go to university. This is going to be a really significant thing for your resume as well, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, what does Fursa mean?
Fursa means opportunity in Arabic.
Ah.
Yeah, so giving the students this opportunity.
So what's the response been like? How many students are on it? I mean, it's early days now, but you know, what's the companies, many companies on there now? Khaled?
Sure, yeah. So the reception has been very overwhelming. So I actually launched it to my school a couple of weeks back, and the turnout was great. We hosted it in an event in lunch break, and the superintendent, you know, I worked closely with him, and he supported it a lot. And in the event, there was a bunch of students, teachers, faculty members. And after, you know, the reception was great in school, and then kind of got this media coverage, which was definitely also overwhelming and great. You know, it's great to see, you know, my name on Love in Dubai. It's a bit crazy.
Love it. Well,
but yeah, the reception has been great from friends, family, and just everyone online.
It sounds like the reception's been fantastic. You talked about it, you know, being in school, but now it's obviously open. It's on the Google and Apple App Store. So how many students are currently registered, and what about companies?
Yeah, so we launched a bit less than a month ago, and the reception has been great, you know, from, like I said, from school and on also just publicly on the, you know, on social media. But we have more than 100 students now logged on, and more than 30, 35 companies were engaged with. And yeah, so we have approximately like 25 vacancies posted. And really, like, the beauty of Fursa also is that these jobs are very flexible. It's not really, like I said, a lot of these companies are looking for really experienced interns. And the beauty of Fursa is that these jobs can be anything from like a 1 week job shadowing, you know, less intense, less demanding opportunity, all the way to, you know, a 2 month full 9 to 5 internship, which is
great. Have you noticed any patterns in terms of the companies that are seeing the value in interns and being really proactive by putting themselves on the app? Are there any particular, you know, is it tech or is it Dubai based? Is it global companies? What are you noticing? And can we name check some maybe?
Sure, yeah. So I haven't really, we got a good variety, I'd say, but I've noticed a lot of social media kind of marketing jobs, interns, but as for the companies, we've got like a wide range. You know, my dad has posted some jobs for, you know, Joe and the Juice and They Sell Chicken, and some marketing
some
as well.
F&B stuff.
Yes, and we've also gotten Karen Wazin, who's a big, you know, they're big on social media, and they offered a social media intern. So we've
gotten very cool
some tech also, a company called Immensa. They work with 3D printing and engineering. So, you know, it's there definitely is a big variety for students.
And I think, you know, we've talked about this in the past on the show about, you know, kind of teaching the value of money and how hard it can be when I had my first kind of proper jobs as a, you know, outside of school when I was 14, because there was a need for it, you know. But I feel like, unfortunately, for teens, there aren't that many opportunities to have paid for part-time work outside of school. And then that seems to kind of knock on into the interns as well. But it's so important, as you touched on earlier, one, for your resume. I mean, to have names like that when you are doing college applications is just amazing. But also to get a bit of a taste of the working world. What are your internship plans? Have you got anything lined up for the summer or anything?
Yeah, so I actually worked last summer with a company called Billion Dollar Startup Ideas. I was mentored by Michael Burvell, who was great. He was a great mentor. And the company really focused on getting these small kind of startup ideas and actually, you know, making blog posts about them and making a business plan out of them. So I worked with a team of a couple other interns, and we kind of created a business plan, and we pitched it to investors and actually sold it, which is great.
Amazing.
And this summer I'm doing something similar starting July, with also working a bit closer with startups. And yeah, it's remote, so I'm going to be working.
That's really cool. So what are the plans for Fursa? What are we hoping? Are we looking to obviously go citywide, UAE, and then I'm thinking just global domination? What do you think?
Like, we, you know, it all started, like I said, you know, with, I work closely with my school, and we got a lot of support from the school itself. But I definitely think there's so much potential with this market. You know, it really is an issue for, we know, students obviously in the UAE, but definitely globally. It's hard to kind of, there's no platform to just search for what you're interested in. So I think, you know, starting, we can, you know, we hope to expand beyond UAE and then hopefully, you know, globally. I think there's many things we can do, but we'll
see.
Take
it to the States with you when you go back to yes. university. Let's manifest that.
Yeah, let's manifest
let's
it.
Let's manifest it. For sure. Thank you so, so much. I've had a number of people asking for your details. So if you want to send me the word intern, whether you are, you know, parent or a teenager yourself looking to get on that platform, or indeed you're a company who is looking to find someone to add some real value on, you know, shorter, as we said, a week up to a few months, send me the word intern. You don't need to put your name on it. No questions asked on 4001. Will you please come back and not forget us?
For sure, for sure.
Amazing.
No way. No way, I won't forget you.
Khaled Haj speaking to us, the founder and director of Fursa Internships.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
We're looking for you mouse jigglers. Ever since the pandemic, there's been an increase in remote work and a growing demand for ways for employees to appear productive to their managers when actually away from their computers. But now we're starting to see some high-profile cases of companies cracking down on this workplace deception. Wells Fargo recently fired over a dozen employees who used mouse jigglers to fake productivity. They were in the wealth and investment unit, and they were discharged after a review of allegations involving simulation of keyboard activity, creating the impression of active work. Kevin Sebastian is with us today to talk tech. I mean, you do your own thing. You work for yourself a lot of the time. So I'm guessing you're not a mouse jiggler.
No, I'm not.
I mean, can you imagine if I was? It'd be a lot of quiet time on the radio.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, when I read the story, my first question was, if they were caught using mouse jiggling, what were they actually working on? That was my first question. And I'm like, if they were not performing well, like, shortly it would have been reflected in their job or their work.
Well, there's two things here. One is you can be, you know, literally watching Bridgerton with your laptop and just kind of moving the mouse a bit so you appear to be active and you've got that green dot. The other thing is you can buy a mouse jiggler.
Yes, you can. When the story first came up, I'm like, wait, is this strictly legal? It turns out, I mean, there's nothing illegal about a device that shakes your mouse or a software that stimulates a keyboard pressing. There's nothing. Again, it's the ethical considerations of what you're doing in your workplace, right? But at the same time, there's another ethical question is like, are you really like, look, at the end of the day, like, are you being employed to basically just move your mouse and like make sure you just touch your keyboard?
What's your output?
Exactly. Like, what is the output? Especially in a bank like Wells Fargo, which I would imagine people are insanely busy on things.
Now, what we're going to see next then, presumably, are tools and tech for companies like Wells Fargo used to monitor their employees' activities. You know, I guess, I don't want to say spying, but maybe spying.
I mean, standard IT protocol in most companies, especially when you're handling sensitive information like a bank, I fully expect IT companies to have a software which actually tracks your desktop. At least they see what you see.
And, oh my days.
I mean, that is very standard because obviously like people can be using work laptops and potentially abusing them for other things. And as a company, you don't want to get implicated with your hardware, which is what IT people normally do. That's why you have an IT department, not just for setting up emails, but making sure that the data that you trust your customers with is secure, even from the employee's end, right? Now, the mouse jiggling thing is like a very serious problem in that sense, because again, my only first question is like, what are you doing then? Like, what is your job? But I also understand it from like another point of view. For example, I remember like someone who worked in the company, not an international one, in fact.
Look at him keeping it so vague.
Yeah, I'm trying my best to make sure no names are named. But what they used to do is they're on Teams. And when they go away, they immediately get questioned by their line manager saying, where are you? So what they used to do is every 5 minutes, they used to like shake the mouse and just go and do something else. And I understand that because say, for example, you're a parent and you're like working from home and your child, something goes wrong. You can't immediately go back to your work machine. Mm-hmm. And I get some of the other questions you have to be asking as well, and more so about the fact of the way we work as well, because a lot of people are talking about how you don't need to spend 8 hours glued to your keyboard and mouse and your machine. You are allowed to take breaks. That's
absolutely
a humanly acceptable thing.
And I think you should be measured on your output, not your presenteeism?
Absolutely, yeah. I think work culture now, and I feel like it's evolving with the next generation of employers, especially with the Gen Zs and the Gen Alphas, who know their worth, who know their value of time, and don't see the point of sitting 8 hours just staring into the screen, doing nothing if they already accomplished their work.
Especially if they're using AI to maybe reduce how much work they've got to do.
Absolutely, and that's another consideration, right? Because right now, I can see that a lot of people are using AI, and that's, I think, one of the stories you were talking about, is how people literally get away with literally copy-pasting what ChatGPT tells them, and then they're done with their jobs.
Do you know what? Like, ethically, I'm very pleased I'm not at university or even high school now, because I would be using and abusing ChatGPT.
Absolutely.
Badly.
Yes. And I think it's going to raise some very serious problems even Wells Fargo can't handle, especially like... You have someone answering. Imagine if they actually is asking who's doing your emails and ChatGPT is doing all your emails for you. And, you know, you don't check them.
And then your resignation letter.
Absolutely.
Let's stay with AI because LinkedIn, which I'm going to be honest about, I find it incredibly unfriendly as a user. I don't like it at all.
Yep.
I occasionally post stuff just to kind of appear present and active, but it's mostly reposting things that people tag me in. I just don't like it as a user experience, just saying. But maybe that's because I'm not actively looking for a job, I promise, to my bosses who are listening now. I think, you know, if I was, then I would obviously see the value and I would, you know, invest my time and really leverage it. So LinkedIn is using AI to help users attract potential employers.
Yes.
How are they doing this?
So one of the things is, and a lot of people really give me flack, is that we're actually giving LinkedIn all our information without even them asking for it. So if you remember, I don't know if you've seen this on LinkedIn, now there's a usual thing from what LinkedIn does from a social media standpoint, saying you've been selected to answer one of these many questions among a specialized few. First, they pump you up and make you feel very special among your peers and say, like, you've been selected to answer this question.
I haven't had that.
Yeah. So I've been asked this question many times. I'm like, wait, this has never happened before. And I'm like, does this increase my social clout on LinkedIn? Turns out that they're asking everyone this question. Because what they're doing is they're taking professional ons and you're feeding a database. Oh. And it's insane how massive the data collection is, because every now and then I see my peers in different industries answer these questions outright. And I'm like, aren't you a bit worried that you're giving away your IP, your ideas and suggestions on how to handle things at the workplace to a social media network, which owes you practically nothing? And it's astounding how that information is being transformed very fast, because now if you log on to LinkedIn, you can literally write a post without even trying, because it'd be like, let LinkedIn use AI to help you write your post.
This is on premium or just normal?
This is normal, by the way. That you can use the AI for premium features specifically, but the questions and the way it's taking your data is you actually are feeding into it. This is Facebook all over again, because we are literally giving it information. We're feeding this massive database.
So you are often the one to get some incredible bits of kit across your desk.
Yes.
What's the latest thing that you've really rated, Kevin?
So I got this thing from Samsung, which they sent for review, and it was called the Samsung Music Frame. And at first, I did not know what to expect, because you got this big box coming in.
How big is it?
It's your standard, I think, IKEA frame, but just a bit more thicker.
Okay.
But the reason why it's so big is because it actually has speakers at the back of it. And what it does is you can like turn your picture frame into a music frame. It'll actually play music from your phone or any source, like the way Sonos has with the IKEA collection.
Not to ask a really dumb question.
Yes.
Is it like a digital picture frame, or would you put an actual
picture? You can actually put an actual picture in there.
Okay.
Yeah. So first from the picture frame aspect of this, it's very easy to slide in a photograph. It's actually like just clip-on ones, and you just slide in the frame.
Okay.
And it's got a very, very specific size as well. Like, I think one of the things that I found challenging is to find a photograph that fit those dimensions.
So it's basically 8 by 8 inches.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's in that same frame. However, because it's a tech product, I wanted to test how it sounds. And it's got a very unusual way of how it does sound technology, because it bounces off the sound off the ceiling. So you get that entirely ambient sound experience with it, which is pretty cool, because it's got Dolby Cinema technology in the frame.
We've all seen it at the beginning of a movie.
Yeah.
That little ball bouncing around.
Absolutely. And, so it's got Dolby Atmos audio in it.
And so does that mean you could have a few?
You can have multiple. You can actually just, like, say, for example, you have two frames next to your TV, and you want to, instead of putting speakers, you can put these two frames and they'll double up as a surround sound system. The only downside, however, is would you justify spending $1,399 on a music frame?
No.
Is a different story.
Well, that's the thing. If you are looking for a really good portable speaker or, you know, or kind of soundbar or something,
yeah,
could you get more for your money? Because, you know, I can buy a picture
frame
for
$20. I mean, it's the aesthetics of it, isn't it? Right? Yeah. It's the aesthetics. So I would put this in, like, say, for example, I would put one on the stand and display music off that. I think that would come in handy.
Say how much? About 1,300 dirhams.
Oh, yeah, 1,399. So almost 1,400.
Not for me.
It's a very specialized product, I would say.
Well, we're going to have to squeeze in some questions. But before we get to the text line, why is Adobe being sued by the US government?
Adobe is being sued because they are trying to make sure they take as much money from you without giving you the option to opt out.
That would do it.
As a creative, this story is a very personal one for me because I've been locked into Adobe's ecosystem without any form of choice. Mm-hmm. And as a video editor, producer, people who work at Photoshop, I unfortunately do not have the option, or any creative does not have the option to opt out, because then they hit you with you already paid for the subscription. If you want to cancel it, you're going to get charged for the fees anyway.
And so not being transparent about the T's and C's.
Absolutely. And ooh. Adobe has been notorious because you can buy the software and you're done, right? Like, it used to be that model, mm-hmm. but because they found value in subscriptions.
Yeah, any
big tech company. In fact, there's known evidence that Adobe has taken products and bought them out, and then we've gotten terrible versions of those products.
Well, it's interesting because I opened my Adobe Photo Fix this morning and I couldn't get in.
Yeah, and it's all server-side. So now you need to be online to use their features. I'm like, when did I learn have to be online to use Photoshop?
Yeah,
turns out they've incorporated AI again. And it's a very sad thing, though, because creatives now, especially those who are in up and coming roles and don't have the money to pay 2,500 dirhams for a subscription, by the way, it's expensive now for the whole suite of products if you want to use them per year. And again, if you're also in a company setting, if you're starting up an agency.
Mm-hmm. How many are you going to need?
Yeah, you're going to need a lot. And they are very much now being sued by the FTC in the US because they are not very transparent about their monetization schemes. And rightly so, because there's like this now, like the creatives, especially if you check online right now, everyone's complaining about Adobe. A lot of the companies now who are in the creative space are actually coming up with alternative softwares.
That's what I was going to say. Are we seeing opportunities for other companies then?
Yes.
Interesting one to watch. Kevin Sebastian's with us today. A couple of questions for you coming on the text line. Anish saying, any cheaper alternative for AirTags? Now, lost luggage.
Yeah.
It happens. I've personally never done this. Do you track your luggage when you travel?
I don't track. If I'm carrying something expensive, I do.
Okay.
Like, it's very specific. Because I'm an Android user, I have the Samsung Galaxy tags, which is like 88 dirhams. But Eufy and other companies also have tags of their own. So they range anywhere. Like, you can even get these cheap, the cheap knockoffs, which I don't recommend because you don't know whether they're going to die or not. But the average price for an AirTag now, if not for an Apple AirTag especially, is you can get anything starting from 50 dirhams all the way to like 100, 150.
Okay.
So what I tend to do is, because the Samsung Galaxy AirTag works best for me, they're 85 dirhams anywhere you go and buy them from. And honestly, they just work fine.
And how long can you track for?
So the best that I've seen, I haven't tested the full length of this, I have to admit. But I think when I take a long haul flight, I usually like get like 3 days worth of tracking.
Wow. You hope enough time to get the luggage back.
Absolutely, yeah. So if an airline says, oh, we've lost your luggage, you go like, no, I know where it is. Yeah. It's here. And you can basically make them do the work to finding your luggage. And it's come in handy as well.
Okay. Anish, hope that helps. Happy travels. Last question from Gina saying, is the Kindle Paperwhite still the best e-reader?
Absolutely. It is the easiest. It is easy to set up. And I generally have had very little trouble with it.
Same.
Yeah.
Love it.
If it ain't broke, you know, like, no need to get another product.
Could it be waterproof?
No. Oh,
that would be nice.
I doubt you'd want to read. spills,
yes. A Lilo situation, little bob around in the pool.
Yeah.
I keep on seeing, and I know I'm totally being sold to on Instagram Reels, people who are in bed with a Kindle holder and then a clicker. So you can lie in bed and just click it and not have to even have your hand out of the duvet to turn the pages. I can see the appeal. Hashtag.
Now you're just spoiling yourself.
TikTok made me buy it. Yeah. Kevin, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. For all of your news and reviews, where's the best place to find you?
You can find me anywhere on the internet on Knox Voyager.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Now, every day, every employee makes a decision. Are they willing to do only the minimum work necessary to keep their job, or are they willing to put in more energy and effort into that role? You might have already heard a trending term on careers and workplaces, quiet quitting. It became a bit of a buzz phrase after TikTok user Zaid Khan posted a video explaining it.
I recently learned about this term called quiet quitting, where you're not outright quitting your job, but you're quitting the idea of going above and beyond. You're still performing your duties, but you're no longer subscribing to the hustle culture mentality that work has to be your life. The reality is, it's not, and your worth as a person is not defined by your labor.
So a bit of a shift, and joining us to unpack this and take any questions you might have or hear your thoughts on it as well, joined by Rohini Gill, Senior Management and HR Consultant for GGC. Rohini, thank you for being with us today. Do you think quiet quitting is a new name for an old behaviour?
Absolutely. It's been going on for years, Helen. We used to call it coasting back in the day.
Coasting.
Yes, and decades, it's not new. It's not new. The reason it's come to light now is because more people are doing it. And of course, you've got the TikTokers and social media, and you know, everything just takes off a lot quicker, doesn't it? Lots and lots of people have done it for ages, but now a lot more are doing it. Fueled by the pandemic, fueled by working from home, people could see, you know, or they had the time to see what their perfect work life could look like, I suppose. But also, so they saw that, and then they also saw that they were working longer, harder possibly, and burnout is at an all-time high. So then you've got that with social media, and you've got influencers, and guess what? We've got quiet quitting.
Quiet quitting. What is Rohini saying there? We used to call it coasting, and I'm confident my old employers aren't listening because it was going on for 15 years ago in a completely different country. I've done this. Of course I have. I was in a job that I was disengaged in, didn't really care about, and would do the absolute bare minimum, go under the radar and spend a bit of time looking for another job, spend a lot of time on probably messaging my friends. But I wanted to ask you there, I think there's a bit of a different reasons why different people do it, Rohini. For me, it was because I was doing a job I didn't really care about. I didn't feel like I was being nurtured or developed in. For some people, and as we just heard there, Zaid Khan saying that people are having a bit of a fresh look and saying there's more to life than work. So what kind of motivations have you heard about?
It's actually more of what you identified, Helen. It's a lot to do with demotivated, disengaged employees. And I would say, I don't know, percentage-wise, 40 to 50%. And I would say the rest are possibly the ones that are saying that, you know what, I can look, I need more time to do other things, and work is not the be-all and end-all. And those would be the reasons. One of the two, you're either, you know, disengaged, demotivated, burnt out, but you can't leave or you don't want to leave. And of course, there's always that small percentage, Helen, that, you know, and there's nothing wrong with what I'm going to say, by the way, is there's always a small percentage of people who say, well, you know what? This is it. I'm happy with working 9 to 6. I don't want to get promoted. Mm-hmm. As long as this is me, I know how much I'm taking on. Mm-hmm. I'm happy. Don't give me more to do.
Totally.
And
agree.
There is no harm in that. But be honest about it. Speak to your manager and say, you know what? This is it. This is me. I'm really happy in what I'm doing. I'm not looking for promotion. I'm not looking to go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But this is it. Don't think I'm disengaged. I enjoy my job, but this is it. This is me. And again, there's no harm in that. So it's one of these three reasons I have found.
The pandemic has played its role, of course, people reevaluating their values, their jobs, how they're spending their time and their energies. But it comes down to really just doing the absolute bare minimum. And your motivations might vary. Perhaps, as I said earlier, I was really disengaged in my old job. I just didn't really care. So I was happy to do what was required of me and then spend a lot of time just dossing on the internet. But it ultimately did lead me to leaving and finding a job I did deeply care about. So we're talking now about what the end goal is of quiet quitting. And, well, I'm curious, Rohini, can it backfire?
Of course it can. Oh, completely. So if somebody's quiet quitting, they need to know that they will be overlooked for promotions. Now, if they're happy with that, fine, go in with your eyes open. You want, you know, that's what you want to do, so be it. And also, Helen, it's such a small world. Such a small world. Reputations change.
So true. That is so true. You'd be like, okay, they've got a great CV, but what was your experience of working with them? Not great, exactly. Not proactive, didn't show much initiative. Can I ask you then, could this, you know, have potential for causing conflict with colleagues if you're looking at someone going, well, they're not pulling their weight really at all?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is it. This is why I said it's a small world. It's not only your boss that's going to talk about you or your ex-boss. It's going to be your team members as well. Unless, of course, you've been transparent with them and said, you know, guys, this is it. I don't want to do any more. I will do what my job description is. I'll do a little bit more, possibly. But this is it. I don't want a promotion. So this is the reasons behind why I'm doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And then you've got everybody on the same page. Does that make sense? One of your callers, Helen, said how to ask about how to manage a quiet quitter.
I think that's such a good
question. And it's something
that
I've touched upon already. Speak to them. Speak to them. Ask them why. And if they were performing really well before and they're not now, mm-hmm. understand why, but also motivate them, and then take a long, hard look at yourself. Is it something that you are doing? I've read research where, you know, scholars and people are saying that actually quiet quitting is to do more with managers managing the team rather than lazy or underperforming staff.
And what's your take on that? Is it to do with bad bosses or bad behaviour?
People are going to hate me. I think there is a big element on how we manage staff. I'm going to give you an example, okay? A cleaner, house help, and anybody, you know, a gardener. We're so blessed here. Just somebody, a domestic, who comes and helps you out for a couple hours a day or whatever. And you'll have some people that are going over and beyond. And if you peel away the onion peels a little bit, you'll see that the nucleus is a really good manager, a really good boss who's treating employees with trust. And the same gardener, same whoever, can be going somewhere else and not sometimes possibly not turning up, sometimes just doing the bare minimum. And again, sadly, it comes down to how we manage people.
No, it makes a lot of sense. It really does. Can I ask you, Rohini, as well about avoiding burnout? Because for some people, it's a very valid reason that they might have been taken advantage of for a long time by management, and that more and more demands put on their plate and none or minimal rewards or recognition as a result of it. And their version of quiet quitting is them going, do you know what? I've got to draw a line in the sand here. This is not working for me. This really comes back to, again, I guess, poor management.
Yes, completely. And we shouldn't push our employees, you know, as managers so that happens. We should be seeing the signs way before, Helen, burnout, you know, if we can, before we can see staff that are performing well consistently. And we can see staff that have started, you can tell by just the way they're walking to work that they're tired, that they're burnt out. We need to pick up on it before it gets too late, and it leads to them drawing a line in the sand, as you said. Mm-hmm. Again, as we need to pick up on that as managers. And yes, if your mental health or you are getting burnt out, again, please speak to your managers, speak to HR, speak to someone. Don't just start quiet quitting thinking that this is all I can do, right? Mm-hmm. There's other ways of making yourself heard. And if no one's listening, then perhaps reevaluate the job, but don't put your reputation and your career at risk by quiet quitting. This is my hand on heart advice to anyone and everyone. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. Don't do it. Talk to people. Tell them you're unhappy. Tell them you're burnt out. Tell them whatever. Don't just start doing the bare minimum, because it's your career at the end of the day.
Dubai is a small place. Message here saying, I had a similar experience of disengagement in my previous workplace. They didn't care about our mental health. Harassment was beyond control. So started falling into the radar, do less than the bare minimum, search for a new job. Thank God 5 years back, I found this job. But I think unfortunately, what, as I said, totally depends on the motivation. But if you are disengaged, you lose your spark, you lose that passion, and you lose that momentum. And when doing quiet quitting, doing the bare minimum because you are disengaged, it can be a really slippery slope to potential, you know, depression and not wanting to be in that place. And as you say, avoiding it, recognizing it, catching yourself, either having a conversation with your boss, if you do want to stay in that role, or making a decision that, you know what, enough's enough. Let's use this as a jumping off point for finding something better. Rohini, thank you so much. Great advice as ever. If anyone does want to contact you for consultancy, what's the best way of getting in touch with you, following you, engaging with you?
They can always find me on any social media platform and just drop me a message.
Rohini girl, thank you so, so much. Really do appreciate it. It is Eid when times and thoughts turn to thinking of others, community, volunteering, the pillars of Islam as well. And Dr. Thuraya with us today from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic as we talk about how thinking of others can actually be very good for us too. Eid Mubarak, Dr. T.
Eid Mubarak.
How are you? I really appreciate you coming in because, you know, it is Eid. We are live. And when we were thinking about what we want to talk about today, I've had a number of messages through the show, seen quite a lot on social media recently about people feeling quite disconnected, mm-hmm. Whether that is, you know, being new to Dubai or friends leaving Dubai. And it kind of got us thinking about how plugging into society, to charities, to community, thinking of others, volunteering, and of course tying in with Eid is actually very galvanizing, mm-hmm. for our mental health. And I wanted to kind of explore that with you this hour and of course help out anyone that is feeling socially isolated or lonely. So do reach out on 4001. Be really happy to put that to Dr. Thuraya. And equally, if you do have any organisations, any volunteering opportunities that you'd like to highlight, please let me know on 4001. So can we start with the positive? Let's talk about some, you know, how does engaging in community service or, you know, small acts of kindness towards others benefit our mental health and our kind of day-to-day sense of well-being?
Well, to start, mainly it targets our reward center. So, and our reward center is basically where dopamine is released. So for the neuroscience behind helping others and giving back is actually so powerful that shows that not only do we feel better because we get this rush of endorphins and dopamine, but we also tend to feel really good about ourselves because, you know, helping others helps ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it can have positive effects on our body. So when we're feeling good and we're releasing dopamine and endorphins, we're actually feeling less pain, so less physical pain. So we tend to feel less physical pain when we are engaging and helping others.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Here's my question though. Do you become numb to a certain level of helping others, then you just start getting more and more extreme?
Well, I mean, I would hope that people don't use it as a distraction, as a way to escape from their own life. Mm-hmm. But definitely helping others makes us feel really good about ourselves. And so we become on some level not only distracted from our pain, but the endorphins and the dopamine actually make us feel physiologically better.
Interesting. Can I ask you about the gratitude, mm-hmm. piece as well? Because, you know, if you are volunteering, for example, or, you know, maybe it's donating, this be the idea of, oh, gosh, actually, I'm very lucky compared to what other people are dealing with?
Absolutely, because we go through something called upward social comparison in our day-to-day life, where we look at people who we think have more than we do or mm-hmm. have what we want. And so we start to feel bad about ourselves. But when we volunteer, when we do things for other people, we tend to have a little bit of a downward comparison where it gives us an opportunity to be grateful and actually feel really good about the life that we currently have, even with all of its struggles.
I don't know if you can have the answer to this, but are there, you know, any, not proven, but are there any types of helping people that are, you know, perhaps more beneficial to us? You know, is it a case of doing things face to face, or is it a case of, you know, working in certain areas or demographics rather than, you know, often as we do, you know, clicking donate mm-hmm. 50 dirhams?
Well, what we notice is that it depends on the attitude of the individual. So sometimes what we might see is a person might feel comfortable to directly help. Other people might feel comfortable non-directly helping, therefore, you know, either through finances or through providing something for that person in some way or another. So what we find is both ways actually is very beneficial, but definitely being there physically can make quite a difference.
We've seen a lot of social media content creators, YouTubers, kind of showcasing, I guess, their charitable works. I've got really mixed feelings about it, to be honest, because I think in some ways it can be quite lovely for people to get ideas of how you can help people in, you know, fiscal ways and emotional ways. But there's also this idea of, you know, are you filming this for your own fame?
Right.
What's your take?
My take is if it comes from a good place and the intention is to raise awareness and to really help people.
And consent has been given.
Then I am more likely to like it.
to give it a little heart.
Yes. Like, for instance, there's one person, I always forget the names, but I think it's Motivator or something. That
yes.
He does a lot of stuff in Canada and the US. And he does a lot of awareness. And he spreads so much love and care. And he helps people so much. And that is something that I like. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's the ones that, oh, look at me, I'm giving, you know, 50 dirhams to this person on the side of the road, or I'm, you know, giving food and, you know, that stuff, I find it to be quite
I think fake. That's an interesting point, because it's sometimes the idea of raising awareness around a value or an idea rather than making it about you.
Correct.
So let's put the cameras away. Random acts of kindness, which I have to say, it's not very, like, British, do you know what I mean? It's kind of a bit like, why would I pay for someone else's coffee? Or if someone did it for me, I'm like, thanks. What do you want?
You know, that's really interesting that you say that, though, Helen, because I think that is the attitude that a lot of us have here in Dubai as well.
Really?
And I think the social society is quite... And this happens with a lot of metropolitan cities, like really big cities, where people are not used to other people doing nice things to them without... something underlying, like there's why why are you doing this? Whereas when you come from closer or more rural or urban areas, you actually have you know, if I buy you a coffee, it's normal, like, okay, you'll catch me next time with a coffee, you know. So there, that sense of community is far more understood than in really big cities. Like right now, I would admit, if somebody were to buy me a coffee, if I'm sitting at a coffee shop and somebody were buying me coffee, I'd be like, what's going on? Yeah. First of all, who's stalking me?
Like, trying to pick me up.
Yeah, and or like, you know, if it's a guy, I'm like, is he trying to hit on me?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of a thing. Or if it's a girl, it's like, okay, does she need something? Does she recommend? So this is the unfortunate kind of...
the suspicions we have.
Right, it's the suspicions that happen when you're in a big city like that, where a lot of that sense of community is kind of filtered out and watered down. And I think we need to kind of get back into that. We need to remind each other that we can help with no intention.
I think it also, coming back to England, so I'm from the north of England, which, you know, I'm sorry, the north-south divide is real. We are friendlier in the north, all right? We will chat next to you when we're waiting for a drink. Eye contact doesn't make us squirm. What we're going to be talking about next is this idea of being proactive in our social connections. Mm. So we're going to be talking about loneliness and overcoming social kind of isolation, I guess, for want of, even in a mega city, in a connected one such as Dubai. How does engaging in community and, I guess, community service help our, you know, sense of well-being, you know, kind of build our own resilience as well? And the sense of belonging, I guess, is really what I'm getting at.
Well, that sense of belonging is so powerful, because it helps with the feeling of loneliness, and it helps when, you know, you just want somebody to talk to and somebody to chat with. Or sometimes you don't even know what you want. You just end up there, and then all of a sudden you feel like this great energy around so many people who have great energy. So other than the physiological effects, obviously, and by the way, it also helps lower blood pressure, which is super important for
really?
A lot of people. Yeah. So when you're engaging in community service, you can actually feel that sense of lowered blood pressure. So if you have high blood pressure, by the way, community service is great.
See your doctor, but also do some good.
Absolutely. but another thing that I would say that's really important is that it creates this feeling of, I'm not an outsider. And I'm not alone. And that seems to be something that a lot of people experience, especially in a big city.
Thank you for saying that. Because I think an awful lot of people feel, and I definitely would include myself in this, not right now, but certainly in the past, of feeling on the outside looking in, feeling misunderstood sounds like a very kind of like teenage emo-y thing to say, like, no one understands me. But, you know, when you feel like an outlier, you know, even in a, you know, in a room full of friends or, you know, a table with dinner, you know, with friends and going, I just feel like they're together and I'm not.
Right.
Do you think that's quite a common thing?
Absolutely. Because you have a lot of people, for instance, that have family members here because they grew up here. But then you have a lot of expats that don't have family members here. So they might hang out with these people who have family members and then bump into other people who they know people and things like that. And then you're feeling a little bit kind of left out of this group that's known each other for such a long time. And then at the same time, you have individuals who, for instance, might be single and then everybody around them is coupled up or vice versa. Right, where there's a lot of single people and you're the only couple. So, and that can help, it contributes quite a bit to you feeling kind of on the outside, not necessarily that you don't belong, but just not on the outside. And so having these kinds of communities can be very beneficial to not only discuss things that you might be experiencing that could be similar, but also it gives you that sense of, you know, if I need something or if I'm feeling something, I can reach out to them, but they can also reach out to me.
Can we talk about loneliness? And I feel like it's a bit of a taboo to say that you are lonely or you've ever felt lonely. But as you're talking there, you know, my goodness, far more common than we might realize. You know, there are ages and stages where we might be feeling more lonely, more disconnected. And it's, you know, become, we're seeing some really weird solutions to it. I'm looking at technology in particular, you know, looking at, you know, dating an AI bot, you know, and having these kind of simulated relationships and friendships just for any kind of connection. What do you know about the impact on loneliness on mental health in the short term, but also the long term? You know, I keep on reading that it ages us more than anything.
Absolutely. It contributes to quite a bit of cardiovascular difficulties. It contributes to due to maybe unhealthy eating, diabetes. I mean, there are so many health effects that can come from feeling lonely, but also from a mental health perspective, you have depression, you have anxiety, you have isolation. So people can really start to isolate themselves more and more and more. But in the short term, you really have the sense of just, I'm unworthy, I'm not good enough, I have low self-esteem, low confidence, low trust in myself and in others. And then it becomes harder and harder to go out because of the fact that you start to feel like, well, you know, I haven't seen people in such a long time. So that contributes to the anxiety of seeing people. So social anxiety kicks in as
I don't know how to interact or feeling more and more self-conscious.
Which is what happened after COVID, right? So a lot of us felt this sense of like, how do I interact with humans again?
Is it a hug? Is it a handshake?
Is it a fist bump?
Yeah.
Is it, you know?
What are we doing?
Exactly.
Especially when people were on different pages with their comfort level around meeting as well.
Of course. And so that sense of loneliness can be very detrimental to not just our physical health, but also to our mental health. And that could be contributed by a lot of things. It's not just a sense of, you know, living in a big city, but it could be how you feel about yourself contributes quite significantly to loneliness.
We're going to be unpacking that further because I've had a number of messages both on text line and on social. I've just literally Google News the word lonely. Do you want to hear this top story?
Sure.
More than 4,000 additional robotic pets to be given to seniors in New York to combat loneliness. Oh, it's a puppy called Friendly, battery-powered, resembles a golden retriever. It's been given away by the New York State Office for Aging. The pup barks, turns its head, raises paw, and doesn't run out onto busy streets. So combating senior loneliness there. Old people and I can't cope. I cannot cope. So many people feeling really disconnected and, as Dr. T just outlined, huge impact on your mental and physical health and is one of the things that can really determine just how long you're going to live. We were just talking off air about that Blue Zone program on Netflix. What were your big takeaways as a psychologist?
Well, I mean, there are so many takeaways, but my biggest takeaway was how important community is for individuals. And I think for a lot of people, when we think of the older generations, we kind of think of, oh, okay, well, you know, either A, they may not necessarily always be there, so it's, you know, we don't always have to be around, or B, it's like they get older, so it's harder to work with them because they're less independent, and therefore they require more of our time. So we get other people to take care of them for us or with us. And that can really be a detriment to their health. And what we see in the Blue Zones is that the more the communities take care of each other, the more the families take care of the older generations, the more likely they are to live longer and healthy. So they're not actually as dependent as they would be if they were not being taken care of.
If you were listening last week, you might have heard we did a show with the founder of Eldercare. So it's what they're kind of billing as a senior daycare in Jumeirah. And this idea of it being a concerted effort to stay connected, to keep on engaging your brain and your body and share stories. And I was talking about something called man sheds. I don't think I've made this up, by the way, but any Aussies listen, please let me know. 4001. When my parents went to Australia, they came back. And in the UK, we've got something called the Women's Institute. And it's like it's quite a traditional thing. You know, when you get to a certain age, you might join the local WI and there's bake sales and they have guest talkers to come along and, you know, talk about what they've been doing and flower arranging and, you know, some community and charity work. But the men have often been left out of this conversation. And in Australia, they have these man sheds. And my dad came back being like, oh, I wish there was a man shed in England. And again, these shared spaces where older guys can come together and do things like fix toys for the local hospital or, you know, share their skills.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, Dubai, we are going to be talking about aging in Dubai again, because I think it's really important that one of the big things that came up was actually cost of health insurance. So we're going to be talking about that. But this idea of remaining connected, because I listened to a podcast the other day and it was an 86-year-old and she was being interviewed about, you know, what keeps her young. And she was saying reaching out, being the one often to start a conversation or to, you know, call a friend and say, do you want to go for a walk or can I come over for, you know, a cup of coffee or whatever that might be? Because it's so easy, whatever age you are, to just be reactive to messages that we get, to be reactive to what's happening in our lives rather than thinking, could I be the one to spark a conversation, to go through my phone and say, who do I actually enjoy spending time with? And to do that.
Yeah. And you know, what's great about what you're saying is that it's actually tied in quite a bit with community service in general in helping that loneliness, is that you give yourself a sense of purpose. So the older generation, one of their biggest downfalls is where they feel like they no longer have a sense of purpose. Or
Don't say that. That was my grandma the end. I mean, she died when she was 94, you know. But for the last probably decade, it was a lot of, oh, Helen, I don't know why I'm here.
Right. And this is a big, big like hit for them, because they used, you know, from that perspective is that, oh, we used to do so much, either taking care of the family, taking care of the kids, and then the kids go up and then take care of the grandkids. Or if they were working, you know, oh, we used to work. And
I was good at it. And right. I this is part of my identity. I'm in a workplace where I'm valued.
Exactly. And a lot of them will say, and some of them will continue working until their last breath. And the reason for that is because they say, I'd rather continue working than just sit around and wait to die.
This is what my dad had when they moved back from the Middle East to the UK a few years ago. He tried to retire. My dad failed to retire. And what he ended up doing was a couple of things. One, he's really into old Land Rovers. So he bought an old Land Rover. We've called her Vera, and he tinkers with Vera and ended up spending quite a bit of money kind of really renovating her. She's gorgeous. She's a beauty. And then he got connected with someone else in like the Land Rover community and said, oh, have you ever thought about doing like wedding cars? So my dad in the next week, by the way, great little money spinner, drives often the grooms from their home to the church.
That is so cool.
And so the groom will have a chat with Dave. My dad might bring him a drink and a packet of crisps. Nothing, not cheese and onion before the wedding, and have a bit of a chat. So he does that. And then he's now been picked up by a venue where they're like, oh, you know, would you mind driving people between the venue and the lodges where they're staying? So he does that. And then he also does what my mum calls drug running, which is, I promise it's legit. He will drive all around the area delivering prescriptions to mostly little old ladies.
Oh, that's amazing.
Who can't get to the pharmacy to pick up their medication. So he'll pop in and have a chat.
Oh, that's so sweet.
But it's the purpose.
Right.
Right?
Right.
He'll get up and he'll walk probably about 4 miles in the morning and then he's off doing something, because he never played golf. He never fished, you know, and I think a lot of guys, certainly looking at my kind of parents' friendship group, it's the kind of the wives that keep the community together, like they keep the organizing the weekends and the holidays and the dinners. And the men often don't really have that mate situation. So my mum's off, she's doing, you know, she's the chairman of the cinema and she's got flower club and she's got book club. And if my dad hadn't done that, I guarantee his mental health, he would have aged a lot faster.
I would imagine even his physical health. If 100%. He's walking 4 miles a day.
He's had cancer three times, is Dave.
That's amazing. and I'm sure it gives him so much purpose. And that's the premise behind all of what we're talking about today, really, is this idea of like gaining that sense of meaning in the life that you have.
And also, we always tease him that he'll chat to anybody. Like, we always joke that dad's like, oh God, who's he chatting to now? Like, what mate is
my mom is the same, really? By the way.
Yes. To be fair, it's quite a lovely quality. My father-in-law is the same. It's a lovely quality. But I've never said this before, but when we were back a few weeks ago, my dad was like, oh, I don't know if you saw in the news here, but basically this huge tree was cut down in the UK called Sycamore Gap. And it was this big crime, basically. Beautiful tree. It's in the opening scenes of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And it's 10 minutes drive from where my parents live.
Oh, wow. I know that tree. Yeah.
So it was cut down end of last year. There've been a court case in the last couple of weeks. And dad was like, oh, I'll drive up with you to Sycamore Gap. Then I'll turn right and you turn left. To get back up to Scotland to get the plane. So he was driving ahead of us. So he's in his car on his own. We've got the family in ours. And sure enough, who does dad see? A hitchhiker who's trying to...
Oh my God.
Trying to make a way up to Hadrian's Wall. So dad stops the car. And I have to say, not an unattractive woman. So we're going, all right, dad. Messaging my mum going, I think you should be a bit worried, Babs. Looks like dad's made a friend, and the kid in the background going, we're going to call a granny backpack. But, you know, my dad is the one who would, you know, always have a chat with somebody. And it means he's got very high standards of people. Like, you know, if someone moves to Dubai that he kind of knows, he's like, oh, you know, so-and-so's son's moved to Dubai. Would you have a coffee with him? I'm like, oh, geez. Oh, yeah, fine, I will. Because he would do it.
Right, right.
And he would do it. But I think what I'm really getting at is having this idea of there is an opportunity to have, I'm not saying every stranger is a friend you haven't made
of
yet.
Of course.
You know, but, you know, if we're in the lift, there's so many opportunities to actually just say, I do it now. Oh, what's on six? Oh, you know, good morning, da da da. Rather than just looking at our phones.
Right, right.
Because it's so easy to just have the head in the screen.
And I think that's one of the biggest difficulties that we're having in terms of forming these communities is that really we are just so in our phones. And, you know, sometimes I enter any kind of elevator and I look around, I'm like, wow. Like, not a single person
makes eye contact.
Acknowledged the fact that I even entered. So it's hard for me to even say good morning without sounding like a bit patronizing.
A bit passive aggressive.
Yeah,
good morning.
Like, good morning. Hello. You know, but at the same time, I don't want it to come off like I'm attention seeking either.
No, I know.
But just that, you know, that hello, how are you today? You know, and I love doing that with baristas and with people that, you know, especially like hard workers in the city. I love doing that with them because you can see the smile that, oh my God.
I feel seen.
Exactly. I feel seen. I feel acknowledged. And that actually makes me feel really good as well.
Well, that's interesting you say that. And I wish I could find the study, but I was listening to Mel Robbins a few weeks ago. I don't know if you ever listened to her, but she had a really good neuroscientist on and talking about a study that had been done where they basically separated commuters into two groups. And one was, you can do your normal commute. I think it was on a train and you'll read your book or you'll have your reading on your phone or whatever. And the other group is you need to forge some kind of connection or conversation with a stranger. Mm. And of course, everyone who wanted a normal commute was like, phew, got off easy there.
Right.
And the others were like, oh God, this is going to be horrendous. And sure enough, you know, when they got to their destination, they did a quick kind of check-in on the happiness levels, basically. Mm-hmm. And everyone that had been encouraged to make a connection, to have a conversation, reported that was a much more enjoyable experience.
Right.
And I could well believe it. I really, really could, because I go down to the coffee shop downstairs before the show and, you know, get a drink before. And sometimes, listen, if you're feeling low energy, sometimes you're like, I really can't be bothered.
Right. Of course. I mean, we're not saying that you need to do this on a daily basis every second, but once in a while.
Lovely messages and questions coming in for Dr. Thoraya, clinical psychologist. No name on this one. It says, I'm a soon to be empty nester. I'm going to have to make a real effort to keep up friendships that were made through my son. I don't work, so I'd like to volunteer for a few days. Any recommendations? I'm a bit worried, to be honest. I'm because I follow so many kind of dog charities, all of the volunteering stuff, I'm like, go to Canine Friends.
Yeah.
A message here from, I'm lucky enough to have some really lovely colleagues, and I'm not just saying that because they are literally listening in the booth and maybe on air as well. But I think maybe we underestimate how much social connection we get from work. And a message is here saying, after successfully managing business in my sector and loving it, I took a big plunge and started my own business. All initially well, but 3 months in, I'm really miserable. I've realised that starting the business after initial excitement is the least fun I've ever done, and I'm really lonely. Not one for socialising in the evenings. I've realised that my fulfilling human interactions come from work colleagues, and now I don't have any. Mm. I'm a one-man band. I'm not in a position to have staff at this stage, and I can't believe how lonely I feel. I haven't got anyone to bounce off, commiserate with. It's affected my mental health more than I ever thought it would, and it's really taken me by surprise. I thought this was going to be my thing, but it just isn't. That's hard, because that's that expectation, isn't
right.
it? What I would say, and I've never had kind of had my own business, but I've been a freelancer and I was much the same. I found it really lonely. Mm-hmm. And I ended up working from a cafe where I'd kind of meet some other freelancers and be like, do you want to come and we'll just, you know, sit and have breakfast and, you know, work alongside each other. Mm-hmm. Or co-working spaces?
Absolutely. These kinds of things could be very helpful, because that person is right. I mean, not only is owning your business and your own business and working by yourself very lonely, but it's also hard because you don't think you can talk to anybody that can understand the troubles that you're going
through. But there are so many entrepreneurs in Dubai who know exactly what, especially the early stages, when you are literally that one-man band and you're doing the PR and the HR and the business generation and all of that. There are some amazing, amazing networks here, and I don't know if you're male or female, but I would, you know, there's all sorts of professional organizations and co-working spaces. Mm-hmm. But thank you for reaching out, because I think a lot of people will be nodding along to that, saying, yeah, me too. Gail says, great topic. I'm trying to reconnect with old friends, build new friendships after a breakup. I realized that my friendships really suffered during the last few years of my marriage, and now I'm single. I find life can be quite lonely. I'm making a big effort to contact people whose company I've enjoyed in the past and suggest meeting up, walks, coffee, drinks. For me, it seems easier to start with people I already know, even if I haven't seen them for ages. So far, so good. Everyone's responded positively, and I have a few things lined up. Hope that helps someone listening today. Mm. Good for you, girl. Love it. Thank you. I think a really, really valuable chat today, and hopefully normalising a lot of the loneliness that a lot of people are going through. So thank you for your time. I've also had people asking about your details as well. So you are at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic.
Right.
It's not just you.
No, absolutely not. It's not just me. We have a lot of great professionals, and they work with all sorts of different people, couples, individuals, young, old, and, you know, they're much better than I am anyway.
They are. Stop it. But do they bring me snacks?
No, they don't bring you snacks. I bring you snacks.
And that's why you're in the hot seat, my friend. Eid Mubarak to you and yours and the team.
Thank you, you too.
Thank you so much. And we'll chat soon indeed. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.